So, thanks. We have a brief overlay update here today on Russell Investments. My name is Greg Nordquist, Director of Overlay Strategies. And to my right here is Philip Lee, Portfolio Manager for the Oregon Account. Our mission here today, we have the presentation we have, but we're going to briefly go through both kind of an overview of the process of our cash acquisition and rebalancing overlay, and then the results from the past year since we were here at the April 14th commission meeting. So I'm going to start on page 5 and review for most of you, and Mr. Russell, if you do intro here, so please ask questions. We do have a bit of a unique assignment, if you will, as we're a passive investment manager, but where most passive investment managers really have a benchmark they're trying to replicate, we're going to fill in the gaps in your portfolio. So we're risk management on top of the overall portfolio, which means our process starts with, in the upper left, we want to know where you begin the day. We take a custodian download and figure out exactly where the portfolio is positioned. And then through staff and your policies has given us a very precise portfolio policy of where you want to be in any given day. And the difference between those is really what drives our process. So we would,
excuse me, for the record, I'm sorry to say I'm not related to Frank Russell.
Yeah, I was figuring to work that I have a question on that. But, thank you.
Sadly, neither am I.
Neither am I. So the difference between where you are and where you want to be is what we call your residual or unintended exposures, and that's basically bad risk in the portfolio. And so we have a rule that define how we complete that, and we basically are filling in the gaps with a basket of futures, either equity index or on treasury bond futures, that completes the portfolio and gives you the return pattern defined by your policy as close as it can. So at a very high level, that's what we're doing is top level risk management and helping manage the overall liquidity. And I'll show that on the next page where the portfolio lives. As of the most recent month end, it's a little bit detailed, and I apologize for that, but the big picture is here is your $70 billion fund, and you have just below in the first column, you've got about $1.9 billion in cash. There is a tremendous amount of liquidity management that happens within your fund. Capital calls, as we just discussed earlier, benefit payments that go out every month. So big liquidity needs, and that 2.8% cash has a current expected return of about 0.0. Your fund is trying to do much better than that, and really our, at the end of the day, our mission is to catch the capital market returns that above zero that's hopefully there. So you see in the blue box is highlighted what our positions are completing your portfolio. So as I described earlier, column one is physical, what the portfolio holds in global equity, fixed income, private equity. If you add that to our positions, you see that there's $375 million in global equity. There's about $1 billion in short-term treasuries and $400 million in aggregate fixed income treasuries. When you add those up.
I'm going to interrupt you once again. Presumably there's lots of people who would love to hold our cash for us. Who decides where it's held and where is it held?
Yeah, that's a great question and actually very critical to this process is we are not holding the cash. We are investing it using futures, which means that the cash can live in the cash account. And you actually have a, internally, there's about $1.3 billion that's managed by your internal cash account, by your internal investment team. They oversee all that. We're really just getting capital market returns on top of that with the futures.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a newbie here. What did you just say? I understand that our internal people handle the majority of it.
Right. So we're really just looking at how much cash they have. They manage the cash. We manage the exposure that lives on top of that. I mentioned the $1.6 billion that is managed by the internal team. There's another 0.6 that comes from basically your equity managers who hold what we call frictional cash, just cash to find their next investment idea. So it's unintended exposure. So aggregate that all up to the 1.9. Good. I'm not sure if I got there or not, but when we look at the net position versus the target, The difference in that is very, very small in percentage terms, rounding error, and that's really the mission, is to keep you close. And what really drives the portfolio day-to-day is page 7. Again, the capital calls and the benefit payments and just the liquidity needs of the fund. What I'm showing here is the day-to-day levels of that internal cash account that I mentioned. And so it started the year just under $1 billion. It had a draw, drawn down to $500 million, replenished, and just jumps around several hundred million dollars a month, depending on the cash needs of the fund. And so being able to invest that and get that capital market return is really the mission. And so that drives our positioning of the portfolio. You have cash come in, we're going to buy the underweight asset class. Cash goes out, we're going to sell the overweight asset class and keep it in line. So just finally, before I hand over to Philip, just a reminder of what the year looked like in terms of the key asset classes that we're holding. If we look at page 8, the blue line is global equities. They had a relatively average year, if you will, about 7%, but it was with some peaks and valleys. It was up strong, sold off, and really just filling in the gaps as that dictates where the portfolio is positioned overall. You also, just over a year ago, segmented out your fixed income, as I mentioned, as short-term and aggregate fixed income. So we show both the orange line is the short duration, 1 to 3 year governments, really fairly steady accrual, if you will, of yield, and the ag a little bit more volatile, but about 5%, 5.5% return on the year. So that's the capital markets exposure that we're trying to capture. It wasn't a huge year. But certainly it's above zero on all accounts, and that's what our purpose was. I'll hand over to Philip to just a little bit more color.
Okay. So on page 9 now.
Well, I can ask you a question.
Oh, yeah.
The fixed income return, is this a mixture of capital returns on bonds as well as the annual return? In a sense?
Yeah.
So there's a capital component to that as well.
Yeah, total return. All right, so on page 9, we have more detailed slides that come in the next pages, but an overview of our portfolio programs, returns of what we intend to do, Greg has mentioned, we are overlaying the frictional cash usually between 2 and 3% of the total plan, and really capture the risk premium. And as we have seen in the previous slides, all three asset classes where we put our overlay futures position, they had positive returns. And over the last 12 months, our overlay exposures were mostly long exposures in all three asset classes, except for a couple of months between for May and June, we had a slight short exposure for global equity because the physical global equity has outperformed. So we try to reduce that unintended exposure. And that went back to positive long exposure when you raised about $600 million from physical equity. And so we had a 1 year return of about $36 million, 5 basis points. So that comes from about $6 million loss from global equities and gains of $31 million from aggregate fixed income and $11 million from short duration. So we do. We can have a long and short exposures for these three asset classes to reduce the deviation from the policy portfolio. We have a rule to do a full futures rebalancing if it breaches plus minus 2%, but that has not happened over the last 3 years. So your policy, your portfolio weights are pretty close to the policy weights over the last 12 months. And because you have so many cash flows with the monthly benefit payments and capital calls, all those cash flows are opportunities for us to do meaning rebalancing to get close to the target.
Philip, I have a question for you. Go ahead. Sorry, So is the intent of the synthetic overlay to get our asset allocation at what we wanted? So you said we lost about 5 or 6 million in long equities, and I assume that's because the market was declining when we went long. We lost it on the synthetic position as well as the standard position?
No, equity market was rallying in May and June, but we had a slight short position with the overlay to compensate overexposure in the physical equity portfolio.
Okay, so we have a little tiny glitch there.
You're winning on the physical because you're overweight, but you didn't want it to.
Okay. So then this leads to my question, which is do you take a view of where markets are going, or do you just say we're going to overlay based on the asset allocation? So you don't try to fix those situations where you can see there'll be a problem with the short and a market rally. We just align with the asset allocation and the returns are what they are.
It's very rules-based.
Okay.
Based on
it's forced discipline.
It's,
okay.
Exactly, forced discipline.
Got it. Thank you.
So will you remind me how you guys are compensated in this?
Sure. We have, as an investment manager, we have an investment management fee. That's the only compensation we get. It's basically an annual base fee plus a fee on notional. So how much, the $1.9 billion that you have in cash. It's a scaled fee that is 5-3 and at the margin 1.5 basis points. So it's very much like passive management fees. It is passive management fees.
So is the report of the return net of fees?
It is gross of fees. The return at the fund level, so that comparing this, it used to be on a flat total fund base fee of 0.12 basis points. So we had a return of 0.5 or 5 basis points and minus 0.1 basis
points. 0.8.
So it is.
Stop.
Wouldn't see.
You're saying stop it right now.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Philip. Sorry.
Okay. So in the end, we were able to reduce the tracking error of the total portfolio from the policy portfolio by 50%. And as a comparison, if you were to do this mini rebalancing with physical securities and compare with our overlays futures trading, we should have saved about $60 million over the last 12 months. And $80 million over the last 5 years.
And that's just indicative of the cost to trade. Futures is about a fifth the cost of trading physical securities, roughly.
Right. So next two slides show the same result, but in a graphic form. The page 10 shows the result, the summary of the result over the last 12 months. So the first chart is showing that we have gained about $36 million. Without overlay, you would have underperformed the policy portfolio by $40 million, so we filled that gap. Again, the second chart shows that we have reduced the tracking error by about half, 50%. The third chart is showing the deviation of our overlay portfolio against the benchmark portfolio. The benchmark portfolio assumes that we have invested everything at the previous day's close, and also against the physical benchmark. So if there is any basis risk between the physical benchmark and the futures, then that would be captured in there. And we, and over long term, we expect this to be very small, and as expected, last year's number was also very small. The fourth chart shows the same transaction cost saving that I mentioned earlier. And the fifth chart is showing the liquidity at risk. So we hold, we don't hold that $1.9 billion in cash. We just have our overlay overlay account and the cash in the overlay account versus, and that's in the first bar. And the second gray bar is what we need to hold in the broker account for the collateral. And the third is the showing liquidity at risk number for the next, you know, 3 day, expected 3 day returns, and we have a plenty of liquidity in our overlay account.
It's actually a very small number, predominantly because we're holding most of our exposure in short term and that short duration fixed income, which has very low volatility. So that changes through time. And so today we look like we have a lot of cash, which is a good position to be.
Again, I'm a newbie. The last chart, counterparty exposure. What's the explanation for dummies?
Okay, so to be able to gain exposures to global equities, futures positions don't have actually currency exposures. So on top of global equity futures, we need to put currency forward positions. And this chart is showing how many counterparties we are using. Because current FX forwards are OTC instruments, and we want to minimize any counterparty risk when we hold FX forwards positions. So this chart is showing which counterparties we're using and the notional exposures for each counterparty. And it's so tiny, and so it's kind of invisible. So the risk is the current gain and exposure against each party, and it's really small, and it's under million.
So the notional exposure says how much currency exposure we have if the market moves. The gain loss says how much is really at risk today based on unrealized gains and losses, and that's zero.
And the next chart is showing the results in the same format, but over the last 5 years, and they are pretty consistent, very similar to the previous chart. Very low implementation shortfall and tracking error reduction is of about 40 to 50%. And the counterparty exposure chart is exactly the same as previous because that's a snapshot at the end of March.
And it's just real quick on the upper left, you see that there's a little bit larger delta, if you will, between the physical portfolio underperforming and the black bar overlay filling in that gap. We love it when it's perfectly square, but when you have plus or minus 2% rebalancing bands, it's going to drift a little bit. So you can miss a turn or two one way or another, but for the most part, with that equitization, we're capturing as much of that risk premium as we can in the right asset class without overtrading and rebalancing daily or anything. You guys are good. Is there any other questions?
You guys rebalance or recalculate the overlay basically on a monthly basis, is that correct?
It's a daily process. We get updated portfolios that we look at daily, and the cash account is actually the primary driver of our trading activity. It's capital calls and redemptions and distributions out of your funds. That tends to be $10, $20, $40 million. Thanks again for your
time. Thank you very much. Okay. John and Kim.
Okay, so first I'd like to introduce Kim Olson, joint Treasury 6 months ago from the State Department, where her last assignment was Turkey.
Yeah. In some ways.
Different kind of terrorist activity. Yeah. Hopefully a little of this. So, Kim's going to describe what we're up to down in Salem on the policy front, and I'm going to tell you why you care.
All right, so as John said, I was hired 6 months ago to come in and look at the policies, mostly the internal policies and workings of the Treasury. And what I did in that period was look at what policies and procedures already exist, how often they've been reviewed, what the process was previously, and how we can make some process improvements moving forward. Now, the issue is there was no systematic method being used to review policies. So some policies were being reviewed on an annual basis, some policies had been reviewed in 8 or 9 years. So what I decided to do was look at some possible policy management software, web-based softwares online that we can use to automate this process to make it something that happens on a regular basis. So every single policy now will have an owner, every single policy now will have a review cycle, and that way we'll make sure that all of these policies are being reviewed on a regular basis. The other issue with some of the audit findings, which John will go through, for the investment division policies. Now, the problem there was that the policies and procedures are basically mixed into one single document. So it's unclear, is this an OIC policy or is this an internal OST procedure? So what we'd like to do is in the future just go ahead every time we review one of those policies is to pull those apart. So only the OIC policy is being reviewed by the OIC, and only the procedure is being reviewed by OST. So I'll go ahead and let John continue.
Ms. Olson?
Mm-hmm.
I was confused by the term owner.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean in this context?
It basically just means a person who's in charge, who's responsible to make sure that policy does get reviewed. So within the policy stat is the management software we'll be using. Within that structure, it just means that that person will get pinged by the software when they're 90 days away from the review cycle, and that person will be the one pushing it through the review cycle to make sure that it gets reviewed and gets approved.
Right.
And so maybe I'll elaborate on that point, because in my tenure, we presented policy updates to you, but they've often been stimulated by something going on in the portfolio. Whereas this now is a systematic approach where everything that happens Tony's going to own every policy in real estate, and once a year, whether he likes it or not, he's got to look at everything in real estate on a systematic basis. So we'll have better coverage. The second element that Kim alluded to closes a loop for us on the audit side, that going back to 2012, we've had consultants point out that we don't have sufficiently clear delineation between Treasury policies and OIC policies. And sometimes it's as simple as something that's clearly an OIC policy, but the letterhead says Office of the State Treasurer. And then there's more complicated issues where you read through it and you start to say, well, wait, that's still under the header of policy, but it's starting to look, smell, and feel like procedure. So this gives us a tool to affect that delineation. And yet at the same time, one of the things that Mike Mueller and I were concerned about is if you affect that delineation, but then it's all in paper form, then you lose any connectivity. And so what's neat about this application is we'll have a policy, and then we'll have a link to the procedure. And so organizationally, it would be much better to implement going forward. So a preview of coming attractions, we'll have a more systematic approach to our policy updates, and you'll see a clear, and it'll take us a while, but you see a clearer delineation over time between council and Treasury policy.
Right. So where will this sit? Ms. Olson, will you stay with the OST team, or who will run the genius machine running the automation?
My plan is to stay, since this is my day job.
I didn't know you were on loan from someone else.
My plan is to stay. But the upside to policy status is that now that everything has been uploaded into the system, and once everyone's been trained on it, it should basically run itself, because the system will be pinging those policy owners and bothering them, and then once a month it will ping their boss. So if they're not doing their job, it'll start to become obvious up the chain. So even without me, it should run itself to a certain extent.
I just like to compliment, John, the rest of the staff, and Darren, the treasurer's office for actually closing out on this gap, because it has come up in the audit before, and I think it's just a great governance improvement. So
nice to be able to be proactive instead of reactive.
Exactly. Yeah. It's good. Really good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Byron, Shannon, and Ann, you're up.
Byron Williams, Chief Audit Executive of the State Treasurer, currently the project lead on the BlackRock Solutions implementation for Aladdin Treasury. I wanted to come up today and give a quick update, as well as introducing the key staff we have on the project. We have Ann Keys, who's with Cutter, who Treasury has retained as our project manager to assist us both on the project management side, as well as bringing some of the Cutter resources to be able to help supplement the Treasury staff. And then Shannon from BlackRock, who's leading the BlackRock side of the implementation.
So who does the two-page overview?
That is a combination of the three of us.
That's great. Thank you. Very helpful.
Are all three of you domiciled in Oregon then?
So I work for Treasury. I work full-time in Sable.
Yeah, hi, Shannon Smith from BlackRock. I am actually staying in Salem for the duration of the project. I'm normally based out of New York.
Yeah. And I'm from the Boston area and community. And the kids are going to spend 2 weeks here or 2 weeks. So I'm Ann Keys from Cutter. I've been with Cutter about 8 years previous to that. I have years of experience in various asset management firms, working with investment professionals, implementing systems, increasing their operational processes and things like that. As Byron said, I'm the project manager for this implementation. I did the fit assessment last spring and summer with and helped build the business case for the Aladdin implementation. I have experience with previous Aladdin implementations, one for a large global asset management firm, and another one was implementing a data governance program along with the Aladdin implementation for an asset management firm of a corporation that managed their pension as well as third-party products.
Hi, Shannon Smith from BlackRock. Thanks for the opportunity to kind of meet with you all today. It's very nice to put names, so faces to names for everyone. My background is I've got experience from a front office perspective in investment bank infrastructure products. I've really found my passion in implementing a lot of systems for our new clients and BlackRock solutions. So my role in the project is basically to deliver on the BlackRock side of Aladdin for the Treasury team. So we want to oversee a successful transition from current workflows into the future state of using Aladdin and fully take advantage of the investment tools that you all have heard about from BlackRock in previous meetings. So my role is really to oversee that transition, work with the Cutter team to make sure that we document out what the future state will look like, and then oversee sort of the slow transition to adopt those workflows and get the technology in place. So overseeing everything on the BlackRock side from getting the hardware and connectivity set up to documenting future state workflows with the Treasury teams to training and testing. So bringing a wide variety of BlackRock resources to bear for the project, kind of being boots on the ground here in Salem, coordinate various teams globally with BlackRock.
So it's very early, obviously, but every day counts. I mean, what potential problems are you seeing and how are you handling them?
The risk assessment, you know, outlines a couple of the key risks that we've seen along the way that we're keeping a very close eye on. Resourcing obviously is one key risk we've been focusing on, and the mitigation there is to make sure that the project plan is maintained almost daily, if not weekly, so you all get an update on where we are with upcoming and past due tasks. Anything that we see is potentially past due, we have discussion for the dependencies, what can we do to get back on track with these things. So as you said, every day counts, and we treat the plan and execution of the plan that way.
So by resourcing, you mean that the OST staff has the capacity to hold up its end of the implementation requirements?
Correct.
And has that risk materialized?
Not to this point.
Do we have any questions?
Well, just as you probably know, Oregon folks are sensitive to massive software changes. And I've been briefed on this by Darren, but this replaces existing procedures and software.
Correct.
old system is continuing to do its job until final?
Yes, until we go make the transition to go live and fully switch into the new software, we will not turn off the old software. So there is a kind of a phased-in approach through the process. We'll do some initial testing. The final 2 weeks before the go-live date, we'll actually have the staff run both systems concurrently. So they'll operate in the current state, the current systems. As soon as they finish that, then they'll switch over and enter the information into the new system. That way we have a two-week window where we actually monitor both to make sure the new system is operating as expected. As long as everything goes as planned in that time, at the end of that, we would switch off the old system.
Is there any magic to the go-live date? I mean, is there any reason that that was picked? If it's delayed, is there a problem? If it's early, is there a problem?
It's given the task that needs to be performed, it would be unlikely to come in early. It's an aggressive timeline, but one we felt was that we could accomplish. But there's nothing magical about that date. If something were to happen and we're in July and we say, you know what, this is a no-go decision, we cannot live without X, there's nothing to stop us. Say we can't push out 2 weeks to resolve that issue.
Could I just clarify something here? This is not a customized brand new software package. This is an off-the-shelf product that's already been used by other institutional investors. So this is not similar to other software experiments we may have read about.
Well, and just to further clarify, too, when we say the old software that we were using, right? You know, in many cases, right, it was deficient or completely lacking.
Well, isn't it kind
certain
of a system?
Certain capabilities, which is why we've...
Is it like Rube Goldberg? It's like baling wire and duct tape kind
yes.
of thing?
Yes, yes.
And it's a service package from Black Hawk brings to the table. It's the, you know, one of the biggest gains here. We'll get access to their support teams. And yes, it is a significant shift for us. Looking back, you know, we started this, started in March. Most of the work on our end has been contract discussions with vendors, as well as process analysis. So we're not designing a new system. We're not building a new application. It's really looking at how are we doing things now? How do we configure that in the new system? So one of the big discussions lately is the portfolio tree. How do we break out all those State Street Bank funds so they roll up correctly? It's not a decision of designing that application. It's just a matter of how we structure it. So it's much more process-oriented than system development.
So maybe just to look back at some of the history of how we got to where we are to just refresh. And Darren, you can keep me on track if I go the wrong direction here. But you know, the whole reason we embarked on this, right, was in response to a number of consulting and audit reports which showed we were deficient in certain areas, right? So this is really in response to that.
Correct.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. And so if we were not to undertake this, right, essentially would we not be, and I don't know what it's called in terms of governmental accounting, but you know, if I look at it on the corporate side, we essentially have a material weakness. Right.
Yes, these would be these were significant efficiencies in operations, especially in the trade support areas where we are greatly increasing our capacity and ability to execute.
And then just to further on that, you know, we try to essentially leverage ourselves as much as possible in terms of how we did this, right? And some of the implementation would have been less expensive had we done it internally. But we're unable to get the resourcing to do that internally, so we've had to contract externally for that.
Correct.
Is that
also? Well, we wouldn't have been able to create the product that BlackRock does because they're monumentally.
No, but even in the BlackRock implementation, it would be less expensive.
Correct.
To the state if we hired those resources internally than if we outsourced.
Correct. So some of the implementation support we had originally designed as being Treasury staff conducting that work, because those positions weren't able to be realized, we then had to contract primarily with Qatar and some with Deloitte for additional services to assist the Treasury staff in the implementation work.
So the reason why I'm saying that is just an example, it's just a great example of what happens is it's an unintended consequence. In order to cover something off in terms of response to an audit report and risk management, you know, it's going to cost the state more because we're going to have to outsource it rather than having the headcount to do this internally.
John, I think the other way this is distinct from other implementations is that our counter or our partner in this process has a lot of skin in the game, in the product, in the implementation. Yeah. And so we will not, nobody wants it to fail. And I think that's, and your living in Salem is emblematic of the commitment that BlackRock has made to make this a success.
So nobody wants this to fail. Tell me what could go wrong. What are you worried about?
Things that can go wrong are poor planning going into testing, such that your test cases can't be fully resolved or lead to inconclusive results. So when we go into user acceptance testing, which is sort of technology jargon for, you know, does Garrett understand how to use portfolio construction tool? The scope of the testing needs to be very clear of what is the future workflow that Garrett will be doing on a day-to-day basis. How do we set up the Aladdin system so we can go in and actually feel that, know what it feels like, feel some confidence, and actually find the result he's looking for that he would want to use once he's actually using Aladdin for his day-to-day activity. And then documenting. Yeah, it works. So we, out of testing, will build a scope of test cases based on what we've heard from our process reviews over the last month and document what the expected result would be. And we'll actually have the users come in and perform those tests. So one thing that can go wrong is if the users just don't understand or start thinking of other things they might have wanted to do that didn't come up in the scope analysis. So we try to make sure testing is very documented, very specific, so that we have clear results. And that leads us to a milestone delivery of moving on to the next phase of the project, which would be to begin a parallel phase where we're transitioning on to using Aladdin concurrently with the existing systems.
Thank you.
That's great. Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, John. Time.
Yeah.
You don't have to
come
up here if you
don't want to. So asset allocation and NAVs for quarter end, March 31st, 2015. One notable item you see down at the very bottom of the page, the Higher Education Endowment Fund, we have a significant overweight to cash, and that's of course because most of that fund is being liquidated as the assets are transferred out to the respective universities. And then I just point out and load the bases on Mr. Russell that we're at an all-time high, so, you know, I won't put the pressure on you. But.
Just a simple question.
Yeah.
The yellow and red colors in the press.
So the yellow, I'm sorry, the yellow is the all-time high. So if you look at the OPERF at the far right-hand side, yellow, we're at an all-time high. The red is the nadir during this period.
Thank you. Okay. So two things. Actually, I neglected to introduce John Russell at the beginning, our very new council member. So welcome, John. And then the second thing is we have a joint meeting with PERF Board on the 29th. So, is there any public comment?
Well, Madam Chair, before we go to public comment, I have one more thing. I realized my report at the beginning regarding council activity was deficient because we did indeed have real estate committee meetings prior to this meeting, and the first of which was on April 6th. At which time the real estate committee approved a $150 million commitment to Madison Realty Capital Debt Fund 3 and a $300 million commitment to Lone Star Real Estate Fund 4. Sorry for that omission earlier.
Okay. Any public comment?
Okay. Madam Chair, before we move on, I just wanted to announce I walked in this morning to find that the Oregon Supreme Court has announced that they are going to release their decision tomorrow in the challenge to the 2013 PERF reforms. So that result could have a significant impact on the liabilities of the system. At risk is some $4.5 to $5 billion in liabilities that were reduced through that legislation. So the Supreme Court will do what it will do. It could either hold all of the legislation part of it or none of it. So we will learn tomorrow what shape we're in as far as that exposure.
Hey, we didn't leave with that.
Yeah, wow.
You know, you got to keep coming back, Rebecca.